This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
This advertisement feature is paid and presented by Go Türkiye. Türkiye is a golfer's paradise, and much of that is down to Belek on the country's southern Mediterranean coast. Courses here cut through lush pine forest, set on fast, sandy ground that's kept in immaculate condition all year round. And for those never quite ready to call it a day, Belek is also host to the first full 18-hole floodlit course in Europe. Local pro Dennis Sutmaz is lucky enough to call Belek her training ground.
There are more than 15 courses. You can play golf in winter and summer.
And once the round is done, long lunches replace scorecards and spas, hammams and slow afternoons take over.
When I'm not playing golf, I usually go to the beach, tan, go into the sea. You just feel like you're in another world.
Because in Belek, luxury isn't about excess. It's about time well spent. Plan your next detour at goturkiye.com today.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parris. So, if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
2024 is the year of elections. According to one estimate, just under 50% of all the people on Earth live in countries where by December the 31st there will have been a national vote. To mark this phenomenon, we're broadcasting three special podcasts. In this one, we're focusing on South Africa. It's 30 years since the African National Congress, led back then by Nelson Mandela, first won power. It's had a majority in Parliament ever since. But this year, it could well be different. If so, does this decline of the ruling party bode well or badly for South Africa? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. To begin with, I want to understand how South Africa's democracy works and what the polls are saying about the forthcoming election. David Everatt is professor at the Wits School of Governance in Johannesburg. David Everatt, can I just start by asking you, how many people in South Africa are entitled to vote?
Anyone who's aged 18 and above and has registered is entitled to vote. Currently, it's around 36, 38 million people.
Right. And how many constituencies are there? Is it first past the post in each constituency?
Sadly not. We have a, sadly not, maybe a bit harsh. We have a proportional representation system with a party list. So as many votes as any party gets, that translates into a number of elected MPs, but we don't have constituencies, which means we don't have the power of recall, but it's a PR system.
Right. So there's no link between an MP and a particular place.
No.
Right. Before we talk about what the polls are indicating for this election, can we just go back to the first post-apartheid election 30 years ago? What level of support did the African National Congress, the ANC, receive back then?
ANC got 62%.
And what's happened to the level of support for the ANC in the 30 years since then?
It rose steadily from there. So at its peak, which would be the election that Thabo Mbeki fought as president rather than as incoming president in 2004, they got 69.7, so call it 70%. So that's ANC at its absolute dominant. And after he left and Jacob was kicked out and Jacob Zuma came in, the decline set in then and has carried on nonstop.
And roughly, what was the result at the last election?
The ANC got 54.
So it went down to 54%. And what are the polls indicating now?
All the polls that I've seen, and of course, polls, you can take them with a pinch of salt if you wish, but every poll is putting the ANC below 50% for the first time in its history.
Right. You said you should take them with a pinch of salt. Actually, some countries' polling is more reliable than other countries' polling. I mean, would you put some faith in those numbers?
Well, I did some of those numbers. So I think my polls are absolutely fantastic and to be believed. everyone, and everyone else's polls are rubbish. No, I think our polling system is quite well developed. It is unregulated, so we don't have people telling us what to do. But it is quite a competitive environment, and so people do have to stay on their toes. So A, we're allowed to poll. A whole lot of countries don't let you. B, we're allowed to publish the results up to quite close to the election. And see, we have quite a good survey infrastructure, which allows us to generate quite reliable results.
Right. So let's go back to what the polls are telling us about this coming election. Is it significant psychologically and in any other ways that the ANC support might dip below 50%?
I don't think it could be more symbolically important than it is. This is the liberation movement, one that had global support that was on everyone's radar in the 60s, 70s and 80s, has taken 30 years to become effectively a minority government or a coalition partner. And that is a psychological barrier. I don't think they expected to have to cross for some decades to come, but it's here right now.
So what you're saying is if you dip below 50% or anywhere around that figure, because of your proportional system, that means that the largest party is going to require allies in coalition.
Yes.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about who those allies might conceivably be. And I think, therefore, that prompts the question, who are the other big parties in South Africa? If you could just take me through them one at a time.
Sure. The official opposition is a party called the Democratic Alliance. It comes in with around a fifth of the vote, led by a chap called John Steenhuisen. They currently run the Western Cape, both provincially and Cape Town, the city. And they are in coalition governments in a number of cities around the country. And after them comes the Economic Freedom Fighters, the EFF. They've been around a lot less, but they're the only party that is growing, not by leaps and bounds, but they're approaching double figures where they were in single figures. And we expect them to be around somewhere between 14 and 16% nationally on election day.
Could you explain to me what the Democratic Alliance and Economic Freedom Fighters actually believe?
The Democratic Alliance would be a sort of conservative liberal party. So they're very much free marketeers. They've taken up quite a lot of the anti-wokeism stuff from America, which is odd because it's not very relevant to South Africa. But they very much push a kind of we can govern. Ideology doesn't matter. You know, we can manage. Trust us. The Economic Freedom Fighters, the EFF, has a rather different and some may say slightly more populist approach. They call for land expropriation without compensation and a whole range of policies that are basically aimed at advancing African nationalism and its demands across the board and fairly rapidly. They see themselves in a way as doing the job that the ANC did not do, in their opinion.
Firstly, who leads it? And second, who gets expropriated under their plans?
Who leads it is Julius Malema, who used to be the head of the ANC Youth League. And when he got kicked out, he then formed the EFF, and that's where he stayed. Who would get expropriated is exceptionally unclear. It was also ANC policy. And as I said, ANC sat in government with 70% of the popular vote and the seats to match and didn't touch the constitution at all. And every time this issue of land expropriation gets raised, it's normally in the context of we must change the constitution. And all the lawyers immediately reply that the constitution gives you free rein to expropriate under certain conditions. So at this point, it's more a slogan than a very carefully developed policy. So I'd be wary about trying to give you a detailed answer because I'm not sure there is one.
There's also the former president, Jacob Zuma. What's he up to?
Yes, there is the former president, Jacob Zuma, who is always up to something. He's launched a party called Umkhonto we Sizwe. Umkhonto we Sizwe was the ANC's armed wing in exile in the bad old days, of which Jacob Zuma, ironically, was not a member. But he registered a party some months ago, or one of his colleagues did, called Umkhonto we Sizwe, or MK for short. It really came out all guns blazing in December. So even the polls that people are already reading, they missed it because it wasn't in existence when they were in field, including my own. But in the by-elections that are being held, it's clear that it is able to take votes from both the ANC and the IFP. So our sense is that in KwaZulu-Natal in particular, it's going to be a real force because, again, Zuma himself is very much wrapped up in that ethnic identity and the space of KwaZulu-Natal. The only question is, how many votes can they take? How much will they disrupt? And will they appear as a significant force in any other province? Indications suggest they may well do.
Okay, so if the ANC, as the poll suggests, is the largest party by some way but doesn't actually win a majority, are any of the parties that we've been talking about likely to easily want to go into coalition with it?
easily is an important rider. No one wants to declare it. The ANC is saying we're going to get above 50%, and everyone is saying we refuse to work with the ANC, you must vote for us. So at the moment, no one knows. I do know that the Veterans League, that is the struggle stalwarts from the decades of struggle, have formed their own league within the ANC. They're very much pushing for an ANC Democratic Alliance coalition. And the argument there would be there has been such an appalling level of state capture and corruption, certainly recently under the ANC for the last 10 years. Being in a coalition with a party that focused very much on governing, delivering, and managing could only do good things for the ANC by controlling their worst impulses. If the ANC were to decide to go into a coalition with the economic freedom fighters, I think most people's sense is that corruption would once again run rampant, and it would be a fairly bleak day for the markets, I can assure you of that.
The other thing which seems to be important is the position of the president, because I think I'm right in saying that in South Africa, the president is actually elected by the parliament. And consequently, if you don't have a majority in the parliament, you don't necessarily get your president in.
You're right. The majority party elects the president. So it would be the largest party, but it would be a minority. So he could be voted down unless they had lined up. So I think their strategy is a fairly sensible one, which is if they aim for 47-48%, they only need to sign deals with a couple of 1% parties, offer them a minister here or there or a deputy minister, and they're in power for the next 5 years without having to make any major concessions on their policy basis. And I think that would be the game plan that they've got going, which is why everyone else is hoping they're going to come in more like 42-43%, where some polls have them, because then they will not be able to make up the gap with just small parties who will thank them for the gift they're giving them. They'll then have to engage their bigger parties. And that's when it gets interesting.
Now, let's talk about briefly about the voters themselves. What do we know about voter registration and turnout, and also the likelihood of voters this time to vote? I mean, whether or not there's significant levels of indifference.
We've had declining registration and voter turnout, frankly, ever since 1994. Voting doesn't seem to be particularly attractive or exciting to people, particularly to young people. Less than half the population is registered. And of those, turnout is generally fairly low. The election we know will be on May 29th, which for us is heading towards our winter. So if it's a cold day, even though it'll be a public holiday, people are quite likely to stay at home in a warm bed rather than going to cast their vote. It's a debate we have here quite often, which is this voter apathy, or is this no one is really offering enough to excite voters to get out of that warm bed and go and make their mark? Because my sense is that voters don't vote to punish a party. So they may be angry with the ANC. That's not enough to motivate them to go and vote. People vote out of hope. Someone has to galvanize them to go and put their mark against that party. The campaigns are only just getting going, so that may happen. But at this stage, it doesn't look particularly likely.
So your feeling is that it'll be a rather low turnout. I mean, you wouldn't care to give a guess about that, would you?
I wouldn't give a guess, but I don't see any reason at this point for it to be anything other than yet another low turnout.
David, if I absolutely were to force you, what would be your prediction for the outcome of this election?
Well, firstly, I deny everything I'm about to say. My sense is that the ANC is going to come in around 47-48. I think the Democratic Alliance is going to come in around 20 and the EFF around 16. But my sense is the ANC will be able to stitch together a fairly safe coalition with two or three small 1% parties and have another 5 years, as I say, without having to adjust its policies.
David Everatt. OK, now let's find out why the ANC has seen a decline in support and whether that decline is likely to continue and what it tells us about South Africa's democratic project 30 years on from apartheid. With me to discuss that are political historian Dr. Aisha Omar, who is British Academy International Fellow at SOAS, Alexander Beresford, Associate Professor in African Politics at Leeds University, and Professor Cheryl Africa from the University of the Western Cape. Cheryl Africa, can I start with you? How much has South Africa changed in the 30 years of ANC rule?
Well, the contrast between South Africa pre-94 and the South Africa today is very stark. You know, I was 22 years old when we had the 1994 elections. So I've got very vivid memories of life under apartheid. My family was classified as coloured. And so we lived that segregation and we experienced the apartheid legislation. I've got memories of my brother being pulled out of bed at 5 a.m. to be arrested because he wasn't going to write his exams as a political statement. My dad went and bailed him out. But if I think about the constitutional framework, the rights and freedoms that we have, the fact that we've got this functioning multi-party system and all these institutions like the Human Rights Commission, the Equality Court, Electoral Court, it's an entirely different country. My dad passed in 1993, and he died before he could vote in the 1994 elections. And if he were to see South Africa today, it's entirely different. So as much as we've got challenges, I believe we've got strong democratic roots and we've weathered many, many storms. And I think that we will be able to weather storms around the elections.
Well, it's good to start this discussion with positivity and optimism, but you alluded there to challenges. Could you expand a bit and tell us what those challenges are?
One is the energy crisis. So blackouts have become a part of our daily life. And then, of course, there's the cost of living crisis, in particularly food. That's a major challenge. If you are living in an informal or township area, there are many other public service challenges and problems relating to sanitation, transport, infrastructure, etc. So the ordinary South African faces many difficult choices, and it could be as bad as the choice between spending money on food versus spending money on transport. And I think a lot of people do look at ANC performance, and in a sense, they blame the ANC as the incumbent party for those governance issues.
Alex, do you agree that these are the things which explain the decline in ANC support?
Yes, I think that's right. Corruption's having a major impact in terms of people's trust in the ANC. It's gradually chipping away at the ANC's identity as the kind of standard bearer of the liberation movement. And that's gradually having an impact in terms of personality approval ratings of the president, for example. But it's also having a long-term impact in terms of the way its performance in government is perceived with regards to these various public services crises that we've been talking about with regard to issues around crime and insecurity. But there are also other factors within there as well, ideological ones. We're seeing increasing divides between the ANC and its alliance partners, the trade unions in particular, over some particular issues around economic transformation. And a major one that's coming up at the moment is the push towards renewable energy and moving away from coal-fired power stations. This would represent a really major socioeconomic upheaval, in particular in the Mpumalanga province of South Africa. And there are increasingly divides emerging between the ANC and some of its core allies around just about the pace of this transition and what impact this will have on the coal mining areas, for example. So there are other issues as well, which are quite significant going on in the background, which perhaps don't get the same kind of media coverage as the issues of corruption.
Aisha, there was mentioned there of the current president. Can you tell us a bit about the current president? Firstly, name him and then tell us a little bit about him.
Sure. So the current South African president is Cyril Ramaphosa. He begins his presidential term in 2018. His presidency is seen as a response to the years of state capture under Zuma. There was this great degree of optimism in the country that, you know, the ANC perhaps is reforming itself. He's generally viewed as a more reform-minded and perhaps even a business-friendly leader compared to his predecessors. He's also has that link with Mandela in the sense that he was Mandela's preferred candidate during his term as a deputy president. He's been praised by many for his efforts to sort of combat corruption and stimulate economic growth. But of course, depending on which section of society you speak to, opinion polls on him and his legacy differ quite fundamentally. And I guess, you know, some elements of political history are important for how Ramaphosa is viewed more generally among South Africans. He certainly played a crucial role as a negotiator during South Africa's transition from apartheid to democracy in the early 90s. He was also a key figure in the crafting of the constitution, etc. So he chaired that committee. He also has trade union credentials, which are quite interesting. Ramaphosa has also been involved in a series of business ventures.
You smiled when you said business ventures. So I'm going to ask you this. Is he a wealthy man?
Yes, absolutely. Ramaphosa is probably one of the most wealthiest people in South Africa. And this is because he, at a period in the early 90s, moves away from politics and really gets involved in big business, chairing significant boards and other things. And so what's interesting is, in a kind of very anecdotal way, the general South African person views him as somebody who is unlikely to steal from government, unlike his predecessor.
Because he's so rich, he wasn't
because,
need to.
Yes, absolutely. That said, you know, there has been a scandal around, you know, some money in his couch, etc., which he didn't declare to the tax authorities, etc. But in general, he's viewed in favorable terms. And I think what's also interesting about Ramaphosa, and the ANC has made this quite clear in its previous elective conference, is that many opinion polls show that Ramaphosa is in fact more popular than the party. And this is why he's been urged to stay on in government, because there's a sense in which he really is an attractive force from the perspective of the voter.
Cheryl Africa, do you agree with that, that Ramaphosa is essentially one of the greatest assets the ANC has?
I mean, I think that there's more of a mixed view. Afrobarometer data 2021, you've got just under a third of people saying that they don't trust him at all. And then another, almost a third, saying they trust him a little bit. So I think people have maybe been watching around the promise of the new dawn, and they feel that the new dawn hasn't actually come into being.
Alex Beresford, before we move on to talk about the opposition, from what I've heard already in the programme, it seems that there have already been splits off from the ANC. But are there splits within the ANC, the people who've remained within it?
Yes, there are divides. And historically, there always have been. The ANC's always prided itself on being a broad church liberation movement, which was a necessity of the struggle period in terms of bringing together different factional interests within a singular movement to fight against apartheid. And it's continued with that kind of broad church philosophy. But within that, it's accommodating very different ideological positions within its camp. And sometimes it's difficult to maintain those competing ideological interests. But on top of that, what we've seen, particularly over the last decade and a half, particularly under Jacob Zuma's presidency, has been an intensification of party factionalism, which actually doesn't have a great deal to do with ideological differences. It's more about who can get access to the kind of gatekeeping positions of power, because those positions of power within the party at the national level, at the regional level, provincial levels, right down to your local grassroots ward levels, those positions of power afford those power holders control over access to resources, such as job creation, such as access to business opportunities, and so on. And increasingly, we've seen this intensified competition for who can control those positions of power within the party and therefore control those resources which can replenish their power.
Cheryl Africa, theoretically, fragmentation within the governing party should favour the opposition parties. So can we talk a little bit about them? Let's start with the Democratic Alliance. What do you think they could do in this election to increase their support?
The Democratic Alliance, they've not been able to fully capitalize on this deep-seated frustration with the ANC. They've had their own internal battles. I think if they are wanting to improve their support, what they really need to do is they need to connect more substantively with voters that are living in difficult socioeconomic conditions. Typically, the DA, they campaign on the fact that they govern in the Western Cape province and they govern in the city of Cape Town, and they would point to their track record. But the fact of the matter is that there are still significant disparities and inequalities, including in the Western Cape and in the city of Cape Town, where people live in really difficult conditions. And I think if the DA wants to do better, they need to validate those people's experiences and not only point out, well, you know, we've got this track record of being the best run province. And I think that would assist them substantially.
Aisha, can you remind us where the support for the EFF and MK come from, and whether or not they could significantly increase their support? And if so, how might they go about it?
I mean, it might be slightly early to really make predictions on the MK, although a recent by-election results are showing that they seem to be drawing significant support in places like KwaZulu-Natal, where there is definitely a resonance towards kind of Zulu nationalism. And of course, you know, Jacob Zuma being the head of that party, etc., and sort of fueling those kinds of sentiments. But I think the EFF is a really interesting case study because the EFF draws support from disillusioned ANC members, especially younger voters, as research has shown, who are frustrated with the current kind of status quo in relation to unemployment, poverty and inequality. And so what the EFF does as a party, it advocates for really radical kind of left-leaning policies compared to other mainstream parties. In fact, it describes itself as a radical militant movement of economic emancipation. Its firebrand leader, Julius Malema, has led a party and made really impressive gains in terms of its political mobilization across the country. In fact, it's shown to have staying power and it's shown to have growth since its initial formation. So the party has been successful in kind of garnering support, which has helped establish a kind of a firm national footprint. It's also showing growth in various provinces around the country. So this is signifying a kind of credible national presence. And of course, this comes back to this fundamental question is if the ANC is likely to decline below 50%, does the EFF become really the kingmaker here or the party who it is likely to go into coalition with?
Alex, can we just talk about the smaller parties? Because we were told earlier by David Everett that there are many much smaller parties, even the ones that we've talked about. Do we know how many are expected to end up on the ballot paper?
In total, on the ballot paper last time, there were 48 in the national ballot. I'm not exactly sure if it's been confirmed how many will be on this particular ballot, but we're seeing a proliferation month by month as new parties come out. So we've got, you know, even in the news recently, we've got talk about a new Labour Party emerging, for example, that's going to be launched early next month. And this is being launched by one of the more militant trade union groups. So we're seeing this massive proliferation of smaller movements. And what this has an impact on is not just the ANC support, because these parties gradually take small nibbles out of the ANC support, but they also take support away from those two major opposition parties, the EFF and the DA. And we've got a situation now where those major opposition parties are not only attacking the ANC, but they're also kind of watching their own back for these smaller parties taking away some of their core voting interests, particularly because these smaller parties can make a very strong, concerted pitch on particular issues that might appeal to a particular section of the electorate and don't necessarily have to concern themselves with presenting a broad vision for national development as some of the more major parties have to do.
Cheryl Africa, should we regard the existence of all these smaller parties and the possibility of the ANC losing some support as a threat to the stability of South Africa, or should we see it as a kind of positive feature of a developing democracy?
I don't necessarily see it as a threat. We've had, for example, a smaller party introduce legislation around paternity leave. And so that is it's a positive thing. The other positive aspect is that they do offer a political home to those that don't feel accommodated in the larger parties. You know, they've got a lot to do in terms of strengthening the organizational structures, etc. So in 2019, the ANC, DA and EFF, they won 89% of the vote. So you've got your 400 seats in the national parliament, and it's quite a low threshold to get in. So it's not as though the voter needs to feel that they're wasting their vote. There have been criticisms about small parties, and there's a lot of fragmentation, and they're taking votes away. But you know, our system is designed to enhance representation. It fosters inclusion and different voices in the National Assembly and the provincial legislatures as well. So it can be seen as a positive. And also the decline of the ANC, one would almost expect it in a democracy that if the incumbent is not performing and voters are evaluating that performance, then it's not necessarily a bad thing either. We could actually argue it's democracy in action.
That was Cheryl Africa with Alex Beresford and Aisha Omar. My thanks to them and David Everett. And just before we go, a reminder that you can listen to the other election episodes, one focusing on India and the other on sham democracies, by visiting BBC Sounds. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Rosamund Jones and Ben Carter. The editor was Richard Barden. And the studio engineers were Hal Haynes and Neil Churchill. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.